This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on December 13th, 2015. On this week's episode, Nick White, Paul Jaisley, and I, Mike Rappin, discuss what we read last week and what comics we're excited for this week. Following that, we had a discussion about our great white whale of comics, as in, what comics we'd love to own or track down to purchase. We go a bit off the hinges at the end, but it's a good laugh, at least for us. Also, if you haven't done so, please take our listener survey at destroythesibe.org/survey. The survey closes on December 31st, and we want to thank everyone who's given their feedback already. We're really excited to send you a free comic. And now, this week's episode. This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are two amazing people who I absolutely love to talk about comic books with, Nick White.
Hey, guys.
And Paul Jaisley.
Hi.
Thank you guys for joining me this week. The old gang is back together. I feel like every time we don't do a podcast together, it's like, oh, man, we're coming back with the original trio or something.
The A-team,
so I always
right?
get excited. Yeah, we're the... I mean, sure, we call it the A-team.
Okay.
Yeah. How have you guys been?
Good, good. Things are good. Actually had time to read some comics this week, which it seems like it's been kind of rare, so...
Yeah?
Yeah.
What about you, Nick?
Same thing. I managed to actually churn through some new stuff and some old stuff at the same time and actually got caught up on a couple old series, and I'm no longer like 5 issues behind on Dr. Fate. Hooray!
Nice. I'm pretty much in the same boat. I sat down on Thursday this week and just plowed through all my back issues of floppy books that I had. Mm-hmm. I was going to start reading The Wake, and then I realized that it was like 1 a.m. that I should go to sleep. So
that's not a casual, like, go to bed sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. So
I think when I'm done, I'll just start Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum.
Right. And then I'll read Witches afterwards, just to top it all off. So what have you guys been reading this week?
Well, this week, like you both said, I've been catching up on a lot of stuff. Some newer stuff I read. I read Batman number 47, which was fantastic. The big reveal at the last page, which I won't spoil. It's one of those reveals that was shocking, but made sense. Like, oh, of course that was going to happen after the initial shock wore off. So enjoyed that. Paper Girls number 3. This book is getting further and further from what I expected it to be, and I kind of love it because of that.
Yep.
But the big surprise for me this week is I read the first 4 issues of Rich Tomasso's Dark Corridor from Image Comics. Have either of you guys read or heard about this?
I've only heard it by name.
I think James is reading that. I mean, the art looks good.
I remember the cover for the first issue popping up on my social media feeds, and it looked really mm-hmm. interesting, but I didn't manage to pick it up or didn't, you know, forgot about it. But I picked up the first 4 issues off the shelf from a shop I was in, and I was blown away. It was so good. It's like one of those books that you're reading and you're like, oh, this book was made just for me. You know, like, I didn't know
really?
That I wanted this book. So the premise...
Can you give us a synopsis?
Yeah. So Dark Corridor, just kind of the title of the series, but the story is basically 2 parallel crime stories. One is called Red Circle. That's the name of the city that the series take place in, and it's kind of like a Jim Thompson novel. If you've ever read Jim Thompson, he wrote like crime novels in the 50s. He wrote, I'm trying to remember the names off the top of my head, and of course I'm blanking. He wrote The Grifters. Yeah. He wrote The Killer Inside Me. Dark, gritty, but also kind of black humor-fueled crime novels.
Okay.
So Dark Corridor kind of channels that. One story, Red Circle, is about kind of a corrupt cop who just broke out of prison. And then the second story that kind of ties into it is 7 Deadly Daughters, which is about a group of women that are getting revenge on the mob families that run Red Circle.
Okay.
I absolutely love it because it's right that type of crime with a dark humor that I really enjoy. The artwork, it kind of reminds me of a rougher, sketchier version of Darwin Cook. It's fantastic. I cannot recommend it enough. I just blew through the first 4 issues. Issue 5, I think, came out last week. I got to run and track that down. But yeah, absolutely loved it. Just fantastic.
Gotcha. That sounds super cool. Maybe I'll grab that trade because it's only going to be $10. Who cares, right?
There you go.
Nick, what about you? What have you been reading?
Like I said, a lot of it really boils down to me actually finally starting things. So I did actually finally read Twilight Children number 1. I don't know what it is about oversized Vertigo books, but Just that general, like, oh, it's Vertigo, I'm important, and I'm also big, generally means that, like, you have to be in the right mindset, because...
What's that $5 like, price tag, too?
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to challenge your wallet and your mind, but at the very least, your wallet.
Yeah.
Well, I also learned the hard way that whatever finish they use on those books... I know I talk about Nick's OCD comic book tips all the time, but here's another one. If your book has a weird finish on the cover and you put a black matte book on top of it, you will have problems, probably.
Yeah,
so
they use like a weird glossy finish.
It's got
on
a slight
cover.
Gloss to it, yeah.
And so if there's any kind of heat on it or it gets any kind of moisture on it, it just sticks to anything. And that's a really unfortunate. Like I was lucky enough to actually bag and board mine, like, as soon as I got it home.
Don't you say lucky. You can say smart enough.
No, it's lucky. It's lucky.
I got the battle-damaged variant of Twilight Children number one. It's definitely got black lines on it that I'm definitely not mad about. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's Darwin Cook, so it doesn't really matter. The artwork is absolutely stunning, and you guys were right. It has a little bit of a Twin Peaks feel. Because, like, people are obviously shocked and things don't seem to make sense, and yet certain people in the city are very oddly at ease or used to this sort of occurrence.
Yes.
That's the thing that kind of, like, weirded me out about that book, and it seems like the characters that live in the city are just like, well, these things happen, children disappear, and then they come back, like, and I don't know what it is. Like, from the one bit of Gilbert Hernandez's writing that I've read, like, that just seems to be, like, the mentality of people in his stories.
That's his style. I mean, the stuff he did in Love and Rockets, the...
Yeah, exactly what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it's that magical realism kind of thing where it's strange things happen, but everyone's kind of okay with it, which is more unsettling than the strange things that just happened, you know?
Yeah.
That's what makes it sort of mysterious.
Yeah, that was a good book, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thoroughly enjoyed it despite issues with the cover, but you live, you learn, and sometimes you don't learn and you do it again and then it happens. Other than that, I did manage to read Bloodshot Reborn 8, which has gone and looped itself all the way back to Bloodshot Reborn number 1, or a little bit character in number 1, which was really clever. I think I told you a little bit about that before, Mike, and I just don't know how they're going to do it. But we'll find out, because next week we finish that series. Other than that, I guess the other one I would quick bring up, because I don't know if Paul read this or not, but I read the Batman Annual number 4.
I read that, but I remember nothing about it. So you have to refresh my memory.
It's the one where Bruce finally goes back to what was Arkham Manor / Wayne Manor / whatever, and they're finally moving all of the final prisoners out, and it's Clayface, Riddler, and Mr. Freeze, and it turns out they've created this elaborate escape plan where, of course, Clayface has made duplicates of them, so when they think that they've moved them out, Clayface has actually been moving out clay versions of them, and then they basically, you know, it turns into straw dogs, and they attempt to take over the mansion, and, more or less get mad at Bruce Wayne, because even though it seems they don't know he's Batman, they know that he's at least funded Batman on a on a certain level. And so they attempt to, and he's like, well, I don't remember any of that. And they're like, well, that's kind of the problem. and so we're going to recreate trauma for you. And instead of killing your parents, we're going to kill Alfred and what's her name? Julie? Is it Julie?
Yeah, his, yeah.
We're gonna kill Alfred and Julie, and we're gonna drive you into madness once more, because we know you actually tried to get electrotherapy, you know, for dealing with your parents, and then ran off for 8 years. So,
this sounds like a really fucked up annual. Holy shit!
Yeah.
Well, it's an annual, so it's like, well, we need something that begins and ends and doesn't really, you know, develop too much plot. I thought they were gonna actually like tell him that he was Batman in the annual, and I was these people have balls.
This is like the exact opposite of our conversation that we had 2 weeks ago, though, where we were talking about how annuals play too much into continuity sometimes. Anyway, sorry. Continue, Nick. I'm sorry.
No. I was pleasantly surprised for it being an annual. It wasn't as throwaway as I thought it would be, but it was Tinian on writing, so I knew that was going to be, if anything, you know, at least a solid B. And Rogue Antonio on art, which basically just looks like Albert Albuquerque, which is fine. Yeah. That's fine. So for an annual, I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I mean, it's Batman, so even the annuals have a certain level of like definite quality control where it's like we can't, you know, with other annuals, maybe we can dick around to some degree, but maybe not Batman.
Yeah, like yeah. let's not shit on our key character right now.
Yeah. So, what about you, Mike?
Oh, I read a bunch of stuff, but the four that I'll mention really quickly, I read Secret Wars number 8, and it was awesome. I finished that episode. I finished that issue, and I fist pumped in the air my apartment by myself. The ending, like the last 6 or 7 pages of that issue were just absolutely insane, and I feel bad if anyone went on the comic book subreddit like for the last like week, because everyone's been pasting like most of the spoilers from that issue, just like, oh my god, I can't believe this happened, like in the most awful ways. That's a whole culture thing.
So this is 8 of 9, right?
This is number 8.
Now 9.
Yeah, 8 of 9. Yes, you're correct.
Okay,
sorry, I misheard you. But,
yes. What I mean is it was originally 8, right?
It was originally 8. This was originally supposed to be the last issue, but they stretched it to one more. But this issue was so good. I won't say anything more than that. It was just, I was so pleasantly surprised by how awesome it was. Just from a pure, like, nerd, I want something cool to happen in my comic book standpoint. It was fantastic. I also read All New Wolverine number 1. Did not think I was going to like that book, and the end page of that book changed my mind completely. And the fact that Angel from the Young X-Men is in it, and I really love his relationship with X-23, who is the new Wolverine.
That's what I was curious.
We talk about Angel for like X-23. 30 seconds here. Just like 30 seconds. Angel can just fly, right? He doesn't have any other special attributes at this point. He's still that rich kid who can fly, right?
He can fly, and he has fast healing. Not like Wolverine fast healing, but like he heals quicker than most. And I don't know if this is still in continuity. His blood can heal other people.
Oh.
But that was like a weird Chuck Austin thing that I'm sure that anybody who reads X-Men or has been reading X-Men for a long time will call me out and say, Mike, that was a piece of shit series. And I'll go, no, it's actually, I liked it.
Wasn't he like controlled by some baddie at one point, and then he got like some weird uniform and shit?
Oh, yeah. Apocalypse, man. Oh, he was controlled by Apocalypse. He became Archangel. Yeah. And he was Death. He was badass. I don't know. It was awesome. And he was Archangel for forever. Rick Remender's run on Uncanny X-Force was amazing because it was all about the resurgence of Apocalypse and how Angel still has this strong connection and tie to Apocalypse. It was so good.
I was just
don't get me started on X-Men,
like,
Nick.
The only Angel thing I know is he could fly, and it didn't really ever seem that special because it's like, well, he can fly, but so can these other 9 other people that also have 5 or 6 other attributes,
and they don't have wings that can be like shot at and stuff.
Exactly. What we're saying is you're crap.
There's a whole bunch of stuff that's going on with this new version of Angel from the past, who's now in the present. You can't hear me roll my eyes, but I just rolled my eyes very hard.
Is this
hard
still that Warren Worthington dude?
It's still Warren Worthington, but he's from the 60s. He's like from the original X-Men team. From the past, in the future. And he has kind of a relationship with X-23, who is now the current Wolverine. For one, her costume's awesome. And for two, the issue that the number one, like, it was a great number one, to say the least. So I'm going to keep reading it because I love this character. Laura Kinney, she's amazing. I've loved her since her incarnate, like from when they created her and dropped her into X-Men. She's fantastic. Talking too much about this book. The other book I read was Switch number 1, which is the new not titled Witchblade book.
This is all about Stepan Sajic.
Yeah, Stepan Sajic and his story about Witchblade in the darkness. And I grabbed it because it was $3.50 or $4 for like a triple oversized book. Wow. And it was okay. I might try and pick up number 2. Like, number 1 came out a while ago, and I just got around to reading it. It was pretty good. I really like, I mean, Sajic's art is fucking amazing. So for that alone, it was worth the read. But it's got a nice little teen drama feel to it, and that just ropes me right in. And the book that I was the most excited about, again, 2 months running now, is Constantine the Hellblazer. Number six was probably the best comic I read 2015. I said that last week. I'll say it again. Number seven, just as good, and Swamp Thing shows up. And it's amazing. Like, I don't know what it is. The interaction between Swamp Thing and Constantine just, like, clicks in my head, and it gets me all giddy. So as I was reading number seven, I was like...
That's how it started, right, Mike?
Yeah, I know that's how it started, and that's why I get excited about it. Yeah. And it, because, like, those guys, they work together, and they, like, seem like they should be working together more often, but they don't. They usually have their own, at least in modern times from what I've read, they have their own, you know, separate stories. And then when they cross paths, it's always two forces of, like, varying strength just, like, butting heads, because Constantine operates one way and Swamp Thing operates another way. And neither of them really like each other, except for the part where I think that they secretly are really good friends. And they, like, would hold hands and walk through a park and be like, this is nice. But they don't.
Buy each other hot dogs from the hot dog stand.
Yeah, and, like, number seven is all that. Like, everything I just described, the goofiness, the giddiness of those two characters working together is fantastic. And I think that's what the rest of this arc is going to be, or the next, like, issue or two. And yeah, it's awesome. And Riley Rossmo's art is back. And this is one of those issues that I know, Nick, you've brought up a couple times, where there's someone doing layouts, another person doing finishes, another person doing inks. And it's really weird, but it's still Rossmo's art. Like, you can clearly see it's Rossmo's, at least, origins, and someone else is, like, probably finishing them, maybe, like, rounding off, like, rough edges and adding, like, more defined lines. But it's good. It was, oh man, if you're not reading Constantine the Hellblazer, you are doing yourself a disservice, because that book is so good from beginning to finish. Like, every single month, it's been absolutely amazing. Which is, I can't say that so much about Martian the Manhunter, and I kind of feel bad about it. But because those are the two books I had high hopes for. And I can't. Martian the Manhunter. That's what it should be called. Martian the Manhunter.
Constantine the Hellblazer. Martian the Manhunter.
Right. Swamp the Thing.
Bat the Man.
Red the Robin. All that stuff.
Let's keep going, guys.
The Canary.
No.
Hold on a second. Yeah. So
just lost all the listeners.
I know. Well, let's get away from this mess. You know, let's talk about what we're excited about this week. Paul, what are you excited for this week? I see our notes, and I'm really excited to see what you have to say about it.
So my pick this week, and first off, there's a number of things I could have picked this week. It's kind of a stacked week for me, but the one that kind of piqued my interest the most was Judge Dredd number one from IDW.
Man, this is
they renumbered again?
No. So wait, guys, wait. Let me explain it. This is a new ongoing series from IDW, based on Judge Dredd. They did have a Judge Dredd series. It ran about 30 issues. That was written by Dwayne Swierczynski. I can always...
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nailed it. Perfect. And that was good. It was one of these series that I think took the mythology from the British, you know, 2000 AD Judge Dredd, and kind of Americanized it in a weird way, like reformatted it for a 20-page monthly comic. As opposed
like,
to a
what
single.
I'm trying to say is they ruined it.
But what it really was lacking was the sort of satirical edge that Judge Dredd has. You know, if you read the British Judge Dredd, very funny, it's very satirical, very dark humor. You know, that's one of the reasons I like it. But this new Judge Dredd series is by Ulysses Farinas, co-writing it with Eric Frietas. Ulysses Farinas, he's the guy that did the art for the Judge Dredd Mega City 2 miniseries that came out last year, which I absolutely loved because it was satirical and over the top and kind of funny. So he's writing this new series. Art by Dan McDade. I saw some of the preview art that McDade put up on his Tumblr, and it has a very Paul Pope sort of feel to it. Fantastic looking stuff. So him doing Dredd, it's going to be exciting. But
I'm going to say a bad thing right now, but I am not familiar with Paul Pope's
Batman Year 100.
All right.
Battling Boy.
Yeah. Okay. Now you got me. Thank you.
That's your homework.
Really,
to
really
read.
rough stuff.
To read what? Batman Year 100?
Year 100 and Heavy Liquid And
Heavy Liquid?
Yeah, 100%, I think. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I love Paul Pope. I think he's fantastic. So, but what really kind of hooked me and made me pick this book is the premise, which is so wonderfully absurd. It can't not be awesome. Mega City Zero is the name of the story. And Judge Dredd apparently wakes up and discovers Mega City One has been transported back to the Stone Age. It's overgrown by vegetation. There's no one around. It's not a city anymore. It's just like nature.
And he's got to figure out justice.
Exactly. What's a Judge Dredd going to do if there's no one to judge?
There's no one to judge but himself. Who just gets really introspective. Yeah.
I think that that is so over the top and crazy. I'm just, I can't understand how they're going to pull that off. That's why I'm so excited. I think this could either be an amazing sort of spin on the Judge Dredd, you know, mythology, or it could be a total train wreck. Either way, I'm on board.
So is this book an ongoing then?
Apparently. I mean, I think originally it was solicited as Judge Dredd Mega City Zero, a miniseries, but I guess it's now an ongoing.
Whoa. Gotcha.
So, yeah.
He just has to file police reports as cave paintings.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
We found these ancient hieroglyphics. It's as if he's charging someone. Yeah. It's not, it looks like a police report.
What's it say here? The judgment is death? What?
He's the what? It says he's the something.
He's the...
Oh, the...
The lar?
The law? The lard? This is really hard hieroglyphics.
He is the lard. Oh, it's early Christianity. Yeah. Okay.
Nick, what are you reading this week? What are you excited for?
For me, it's a big deal, because I've got two books ending this week. What's more interesting is one of them I had been planning for a while, and the other kind of completely came out of left field. Justice League United has sort of been, like, I mean, DC, if anything, they give really good notice when they're killing things. Like, you know, so...
Omega
like, guess
Man,
what?
You mean? Like...
Oh, man.
I will get you started. Don't follow that
train of thought. I mean, to DC's credit, they warned us about 4 months ago. They said, Nick White, all those things you love will die.
That was the solicit. It's really funny.
Wow. Yeah, and then it says, final issue in all caps underneath, like they always do. But... Justice League United, I'm really sad to see that go. It's kind of been the dumping ground for everything weird, and what I love is they not only took all the people that really didn't have a book and threw them there, but then they're like, we're going to dig up some other people that really we haven't seen in a while, so like Sergeant Rock and Vandal Savage.
Well, they got to bring Vandal Savage into the forefront because of the...
Because of Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, I'm sure that's not a complete accident. But if anything else, we get travel form and art for the final issue, so very, very happy about that. But the other big one that really came out of left field is Ivar Timewalker is ending at issue 12, and this is the first time we've seen a Valiant book go for what I would consider to be the length of a maxi series, I guess. Yeah. It's technically a maxi series. Really interested to see what happens, because the preview announces that he will be giving up the mantle, forcibly or not, dead or alive, who knows, of Timewalker. So there really aren't that many candidates, or at least in my mind, many candidates for who will get it. So I'm interested to see what happens there. Equally interested to see whether or not this giving up of the mantle involves him actually dying or not, because it is difficult for him to be killed. But as I've told you, I wonder if this actually is going to loop into Valiant's getting ready for this summer, where they're actually going to really make a full-blown effort to build up that year 4001 universe.
And this is their like summer. They're doing like an actual event, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's starting with the Free Comic Book Day issue. They just announced all of the Free Comic Book Day issues a couple days back, and Valiant's is going to be the introductory issue to this series, which I think is just simply being called 4001 AD. So, yeah.
Rye. That's all I can think of. I think you told this to me, and all I could think of was, this is going to be all about Rye, and I'm going to have to sink all my money into freaking Valiant, because I love the Rye series.
If the Rye title actually closes, and then this one opens, you know, because Valiant is very, very, very sensitive and aware to the idea of, you know, not having too many books, so they, you know, open things and shutter things if, you know, one character is getting too much overlap, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, Ivar Timewalker 12. Didn't even know it was ending until like 2 days ago.
Gotcha. Well, for me this week, what I'm excited for, like I have a pretty good week, and I feel like all the books that are coming out this week are actually books that I've talked about in other podcast episodes. And because for some reason this week happens to be like all the books that I'm always really excited for, like Autumn Lands, Tooth and Claw, and Wicked and Divine. Ooh. And stuff. But Invincible number 126 is coming out this week. And I don't know if anybody's following Invincible, but they did this whole thing where at two or three issues ago, they did a full reboot of the series, in quotes, heavy quotes there. Reboot in the sense that Mark Grayson has been transported back to his parents' house with no powers, and it's the exact same premise and opening as issue number one of Invincible.
What?
But Mark has all of the knowledge of what's happened over the last X years. Like, because we really don't know, like, the full timeline in terms, but we do know, like, events and major plot points in the series. So I think Kirkman's kind of, like, taking a stab at this time travel thing and just poking fun at it. But it's been really, really cool because, like, Mark, for instance, I mean, this is spoilers for Invincible 1 through 6, whatever. But, you know, Mark Grayson, his dad is Omni-Man, and it turns out he was a mole for this alien race called the Viltrumites. He was going to take over Earth. So Mark, knowing that this is going to happen, and in the first arc of the series, he gets his ass kicked by his dad because he wants to try to stop him from trying to take over the world. He goes and he warns all of the Guardians of the Globe that end up getting killed by his dad, saying, "My dad's going to do this. I'm going to go talk to him, try to convince him not to, because where I'm from, he doesn't do it. Or he does kill these people, but he decides not to take over the planet." So, like, we've got, like, he's got a second chance at trying to fix the world and making sure all these people don't die. But, like, the ramifications of that are just, like, exponentially expanding. Because once you start to change one thing, that, you know, changes a million billion other things. So it's been a really cool thing where, like, Kirkman, I think, is almost to a meta level just playing with this idea of alternate timelines and how things can be affected by, you know, when someone gets transported into the past with their memories. And it's been really fun because in this book is needed a couple facelifts and needed a little bit of help. And Kirkman has done enough to write this story in an interesting past that it doesn't feel like renumberings on purpose or like where it's like shoving in your face and, you know, just deal with this, you idiots, kind of stuff that like Marvel and DC have been doing. Instead, he's totally aware, like the covers are fully aware that this is a reboot and they're making fun of the idea of rehashing old storylines and stuff like that. So it's been a real treat just to see all these characters react and see a lot of characters who have been dead for a while come back, which is like, I'm starting to see why comic book major or the big two want to bring back dead characters, because we as creators, readers, really like those characters. And so it's just been a fun like play on comic books for the last two or three issues. And I've really, really enjoyed it. So I'm like looking forward to see how this is all going to fix itself, because Kirkman has said that this isn't how it's going to be forever, maybe. But I have a feeling he's gonna bring everything back and somehow make it work, because he always does that, and he always does it in the most gracious, like elegant way with this series. I don't know what it is, but he still has a lot of like love for this series, and I will read it till it's done. Period. Like he's sold me 100 times over on this book. So if you're not reading Invincible, there's a shitload of
you've got some catching up to do.
Issues.
If you're not reading Invincible, check your bank account and then
go buy those big omnibuses. I mean, for 50, 60 bucks, you can get almost 50 issues of Invincible. That's kind of a steal.
Yeah.
So one small thing that I actually was going to mention at the beginning of the show, but I totally forgot because I'm an awful human being. But I also want to tell you guys, because I wanted this to be on the show, was we actually got an email from a guy named Ray who said that he loves the show, and that's super cool, right? And he said that we are by far the best comic book podcast there is. And he was super happy. He said, "Thank you for turning me on to Lazarus." So I think we should all, you know, pat ourselves on the back for a quick moment.
If not only Paul, because not Paul.
Not me. I didn't recommend
Paul. No, doesn't like that book.
But you know what? Nick and I think we did a good enough job doing this. So thanks for nothing, Paul. No, I wanted to say thank you to Ray for writing to us. Like, we don't get a lot of listener feedback. Despite, there's a survey out there, and if you fill it out, we'll give you a free comic book thing. Until December 31st, I should also add that. But yeah, this is awesome. Like, thank you, Ray, for writing us in. I don't, how do you guys feel about this? I don't know if you're excited or as like giddy as I am, but it's totally
fantastic.
Love it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I doing this podcast. There's another podcast I do, and like getting feedback from people is really great because it means not only did they enjoy it, but they took the time to let you know. I always appreciate that. So thank you, Ray. Thank you for everybody who's listening. And if you do enjoy the show, please let us know because we love to read those emails.
Yeah, and we also love talking about what people want us to talk about, things like that too.
Yeah.
Exactly. I really appreciate the feedback. What can I say? It's always nice to sometimes back in the deep dark recesses of your mind, you're always wondering if there's anyone out there other than the family and friends that you shackle to the chair and say, "Isn't this good? Isn't this good?" and then they cry. It's really good to know that there are actually people out there that are listening to this and enjoying it. As Mike said, it's fantastic to hear that we're influencing people's picks, and I'm really glad you like Lazarus. It's a fantastic book, and we've got plenty of other recommendations, which you might not enjoy as much, but, you know, we can't bat 1,000.
Yeah. My hope is that he picked up Lazarus simply to spite Paul for some unknown reason.
Man, I don't know. Sorry, Ray.
He just loved those moments whenever Paul would be like, "Well, I like, you know, this is another book by Greg Rucka, but Lazarus, I don't know." And then I'm just like, this every time just makes me furious. That's fantastic. That's great. And of course, you know, we would welcome any and all feedback, unless it's negative. So keep
that to yourself.
Keep that to yourself. I'm just kidding.
You can send it to me. It's all right. I'll beat these guys off air,
send it to Mike. He'll put on the kid gloves and
yeah. So, anyways, let's move on. I just wanted to say thank you to Ray. But this week, our focal topic is actually going to be, and I know I gave you guys a little bit of time to kind of prepare for this because it's a bigger question, but it's what is your comics collection, quote, great white whale? This is actually an idea submitted by Tia, who was on the episode last week. She said, you know, what's your comics collection great white whale? Like, what's a book that you've been yearning to find or you've been meaning to find a cover, or like it's the one book in your collection that would really make your collection complete or closer to complete, that's really either hard to find or you just haven't been able to find it. Do you either of you guys have anything like that?
I have a couple that come to mind. Currently, my great white whale would be the Jaime Hernandez variant for Archie number 4, which I could not find anywhere. But that's an example of a more recent one.
You should have told me.
I know.
That's okay.
The problem is I didn't do any research. I didn't realize that there was a Jaime Hernandez variant until the day after the book came out. So.
Oh, okay.
But that's
obvious. See, I figured it out when I was looking at the covers and I said, "What's that weird one?
What's this ugly one that no one would buy?" But
I'm just kidding. It was still kind of weird, though.
But, you know, for me, I guess the one that always sticks out for me is not a single issue or a cover. It's really a series that I want to read, I want to collect, and I want to collect it in a certain way, if that makes sense. It's the Jack Kirby's 2001 series that he did in the mid-70s, which is a book that will never be reprinted. So the only way I'll be able to read it is in the individual original issues, which are easy to get. I know if I go on eBay, I can pay money to get them. I've seen them in comic book stores for exorbitant prices. It was one of those books I kind of just want to stumble across and have the complete series there in like a dollar bin. Does that make sense? It's like a very specific way of me discovering it. And I think that's what kind of this question of what a great white whale, that intrigued me because it's less the issue itself, it's the search for it, and it's the way you discover it that really makes it worthwhile.
Totally.
Paul's like, "I want to find it in a way that I screw over someone who doesn't know what they have instead of someone who clearly knows that they have something I want screwing me over."
Well, which it's, like, it's that thing you know, the other
it's capitalism, thing that, Paul. You're just preparing yourself for the future Trump empire. You're just locking it down.
Yeah. You know, it's like, because the other thing I collect other than comics is records, and it's very easy to go on eBay or other services and find records I want and just have someone ship them to me. But part of the being a collector in my mind is going to record stores, going to comic book shops, you know, rolling up your sleeves and just digging through the dollar bin, digging through the old stuff and finding that gem that, you know, you didn't even maybe didn't know you wanted until it's right there in front of you. But the book that's always been eluding my, you know, discovery in that way has been the Jack Kirby 2001.
Gotcha.
No, there's definitely, you really hit on it right there when you said it's just completely about, or at least it's somewhat about that whole aspect of discovery. It sort of reminds me of this minor anecdote of, I think when I was maybe 10 or 11, I was in Colorado visiting my cousin, and I was really big into collecting rocks at that point, and she had told me that there was this quarry, you know, a couple towns over that was known for like having garnets, you know, and, you know, I could have gone to a rock show or gone to a rock shop and like, you know, bought a garnet. It would have, you know, not been that big of a deal. But I went over there and I sat there for like 5 or 6 hours turning over all of these huge, like just pieces of, I think just like metamorphic rock. And, oh, is there a little garnet on here? Nope, nope, nope. And for like 4 hours I did that. And then I found a garnet, which is probably about half an inch, you know, across. Mm-hmm. It's not that big, but of course, yeah. You know, the feeling of accomplishment, it was like, holy fuck, I'm the one who found this.
Yeah.
And that's worth so much more than, yeah, you could go out there and buy it. And I think you're right. There's one of these big aspects of this whole great white whale is that it has to come with this driven sense of stubborn insanity, I suppose. Yeah. because for me, it was like, I couldn't find Unity Volume 4. This is a trade,
oh,
mind
yeah.
you. This,
yeah,
is not yeah. a, this is not an old trade.
I assisted in
this is
search.
Not a rare trade. This is not an out-of-print trade. This is just a book that all of the shops I usually tend to go to, and a couple of the bookstores I usually tend to go to, they always stock Unity. And for some odd reason, when it hit Volume 4, no one would carry it.
I or, was like, man, it was such a great seller that you just couldn't get your hands on it quick enough.
They couldn't keep it in stock.
Yeah. They couldn't, yeah, it was just flying off the shelves. Flying off the shelves at a rate that no one knew it was a book when I asked them about it.
Yeah, yeah.
What's that book? No, what's that? And so, of course, I could go on Amazon and buy it, but it's just stubborn, just absolutely stubborn. I could have gone on Amazon and probably paid less or the same price. This yeah, is not some yeah. item that was like driven by scarcity to some insane price. This is just the same price, and it's like, Nick, I'm right here, just click. It's not that hard, but just got stubborn and just had to keep looking and looking and looking for it. Eventually I had to buy it on a Comixology sale, so I felt kind of like I gave up, but what can you do?
But that wow. so your search for that was purely driven by, you know, this is a series you're reading in trade.
Yeah.
Right? It's okay. It's not like,
and that's one of those scary things about the whole yeah. white whale thing is that it really goes back to that idea of how have you been collecting the book? Do you want to keep collecting it that way? Or do yeah. you like, is there a compromise point where you're like, you know what, I'll just go find it digitally? Or you know what, I wanted to read this in singles, but I'll just wait for the trade. I mean, and you think it won't bother you, but it just kills you. Like, I yeah. have every volume of Batman and Robin New 52 in beautiful dust jacket hardcover, except for number 3, which I have in paperback. And it's just like,
oh, it irks you. Oh, yeah, you see it on the shelf and you want to cry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're like, who are you?
I look at my collection of Harry Potter books. This is in the same way, where I like got number 1 from my aunt when I was very young. And then yeah. I bought volume 2, like, because it was the only copy they had was a hardcover. And then I bought volume 3 in paperback on eBay because I hadn't, like, owned my own copy. And then I bought volume 4. I got volume 4 gifted to me as a hardcover. Volume 5 I bought as a softback because I couldn't find a hardcover. And then book 6 and book 7. Those books I pre-ordered on Amazon because I was old enough to understand how purchasing actually worked. And I realized that I could get them in advance at Barnes & Noble or on Amazon, like in the deluxe hardcover. And now I look at them on my shelf and I go, I just want to burn all these books and buy like a deluxe set so that just to say, like, look at this unified series that I've read 100 times over. You know, and like I cherish these books and I want to have very nice copies of them. Just like, you know, you see the Lord of the Rings books in the store and you're like, I could buy all 3 of these in like this deluxe, nice looking leather bound blah 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 because I've read my shitty paperbacks 100 times over. But you want like a nice presentation for those books, right? Or yeah. Maybe that's not what you're going for with Nick, with this, Nick. But I feel like
no,
I can kind
no,
of relate
it's
with the Harry Potter books a little bit.
It's absolutely. I mean, even on the same Harry Potter note, I actually, crazy hipster, I got into Harry Potter before it was really popular, which is actually true.
Sure, Nick, sure.
And my hardcover copy of number one was so ahead of the rest that it didn't have that little square that says year one, and maybe I've told this story before, but it actually didn't have that. It didn't have that marking of like year one on it. And
because they weren't sure if it was going to continue past the first book?
See, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. But, you know, she's always said that she had it planned out from the beginning, but maybe her publisher was like, uh-huh, nine books, six books or whatever. We've heard this story before.
Yeah.
We're just going to not
do that. Seven books.
Whatever. I don't know. Whatever.
It matters to me.
I'm a true fan over here.
Harry Potter right now.
Expelliarmus and Snape and Dumbledore and Horcruxes and I've only seen the first movie as well. Who cares?
God damn it, Nick.
And, you know, the whole point, my grandfather, may he rest in peace, he left the book out on his porch one day and it rained. And so that's a sort of white whale scenario that if I cared more, maybe I would be driven to that point of madness where it's like, I got to find the unmarked hardcover of Harry Potter, you know, where it doesn't have that. But thankfully, I've not indulged that madness.
But you have with comics.
Can you even imagine what it... I don't even want to know what that would go for these days. That's just... Yeah. Yeah. No, but really, a lot of this whole great white whale thing boils down to, like, have you locked yourself into a situation where you just won't compromise in any other way? I mean, Paul's scenario with the 2000 thing, I mean, you don't have a choice. Like, there are no options on the table, which maybe that's mentally more reassuring than the idea that it's like, you know, it's on Comixology for, like, $5. Quit being fucking psycho.
Well, I mean, I've done that, too, where it's like, I was at a comic show, and there was, in the dollar bin, one of the vendors had issues 2 through 8 of OMAC for $1 piece. I'm buying this, and then I got home, like, oh, I'll put these right next to the paperback trade I have of OMAC 1 through 8. I already have the comics.
Yeah.
But something about finding them in that way, I'm like, oh, I can't not buy these. I can't just sit here.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, Mike, what about you?
Well, my two great white whales in that regard are books that I'm never going to be able to find unless I come across them in like the most obscure, weird way, or I pay a large sum of money for them. And the two of them, one of them is Uncanny X-Men 256, I think, or 253, one of those. First appearance of Gambit.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
I've wanted a copy of that book for a very long time, and every time I go to a shop, every time I go to a comic shop that has a lot of back stock, I just look through their Uncanny X-Men, I go, maybe this is the one that just has a copy, and they just put it in there because it's shitty. I don't even care about the quality of the book. I just want to have a copy of that, just to say, like, I really love this character, I have this book. Like, it's a treasure for me to say I have it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's stupid, and it's like, it's so 90s in the sense that, like, that's what people did. You know, they tracked down all these first appearances, and people still do that, you know, for really old books. But, like, if I could care about any of them, it's that's the one. And for no particular reason other than I just love that character a lot. And I own all of his other series in single issues. I own all of his other appearances in those books, and that would be the, like, topper to my Gambit collection. I don't own all of his books in single issues. I think two of them I own in trades, but nonetheless, I want to have copies of all of them for my own sanity. Like, to say I own all the shit with him, like, solo series wise. Yeah. And Uncanny X-Men wasn't a solo book, but it's still his first appearance, and that's a big deal as far as, you know, creation of characters. So that's like a whole, it's a whole, like, thing, because you can find it online for like $75, but then it's like, it's CGC graded, and I'm like, I don't care about that. I just
don't care.
Just want the book. And I know we talked on another episode, specifically this is to you, Paul.
Yeah.
About how, like, you don't board your comics because you don't necessarily care that much to the point of, like, preserving, like, the crispness of the book, or you just want to, like, have your books.
Yeah.
And
every once in a while, Paul just shuffles a bunch of them into a pile and just, you know, starts like a sort of Viking funeral pyre and, like, pushes it off into the lake.
Yeah. And I'm kind of the same way about this Gambit book. Like, I don't necessarily care about the quality. I just would like to own a copy for myself.
Well, it's a Gambit book, so clearly you don't care about the quality. I could just see Mike going into a whole bunch of shops, and he's like, you know, do you have Extraordinary X-Men? What did you say, 257 or whatever?
Uncanny X-Men, 253, I think. The number's wrong. Right. I don't remember what the number is.
He's like, first appearance of Gambit, and then the guy's like, who?
Yeah.
Or just laughs.
Yeah, well, in my other book, I'm going to just stop you right there, Nick. I'm moving on.
I'm sorry. Like, last week, I think you just had too much, like, reinforcement of Gambit.
I know, I did. And it's like... Somebody encouraged me, and I was like, ooh, okay, let's talk about this, like, love fest that I have. but no, my other book is a copy of Silver Surfer number one from the most recent run of Silver Surfer, which I think was last year. There's a variant cover that was by, I don't know how to say his name, Francesco Francavilla. He did the most beautiful, it's like quite honestly one of the most beautiful covers for a comic book I've ever seen.
Is it orange?
No, it's not orange. It's black and white, and it's just this little, it's black on white, or white on black, and it's just this little Silver Surfer skimming across the galaxy. And there's a little planet in the bottom corner, and it's just like dots. Like, it's my background on every computer that I have. Like, someone made like an extended version of that and posted it online, and it's one of the most gorgeous minimalistic like comic covers I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And it's like work like that, or work like Jonathan Hickman's, like the cover work that he did for the Nightly News. It's like things like that I really appreciate, like the precision of. And I cannot find, for the life of me, I cannot find a copy of that cover. I remember when it came out, I was looking for it. I remember just being obsessed with this cover for a while, because I would love to just have it hanging on my wall and go, that is what a good comic book cover looks like. It conveys everything you need to know about this character in a cover without word bubbles, without anything insane. And I don't think I can find a copy of this. I've looked at a bunch of shops here in New York, and I've looked online, and you can get it for like I said, $50 to $75. I want to come across it on my own. Even if I have to pay, you know, $40 in a shop, I'd at least like to find it. And it's that same thing that you were kind of talking about, coming across it on your own rather than just saying, let's use the internet to find this.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful
cover. Let's fix this issue with money.
yeah.
Right.
Because that's not what it's about. I mean, like, a lot of this, you know, great white whale stuff is all about the drive and determination, like you guys said. And you
the insanity, just... The irrational yeah, exactly. insanity yeah. that it drives is. You.
It's insanity, but it's like you're putting in a lot of... In a way, you're, like, putting in a lot of work for something in a strange way. You're going out, you're taking the time to go visit a place and search through the backlog or search through all these other things to try to find this gem. It's mm-hmm. it's the perfect comparison to what Nick was just saying, you know, literally flipping over rocks to find this gem. And that's what we're trying to do, you know, with these things. And maybe it's to have the prestige of saying, I own the first appearance of Gambit. Like, and that's partially what it is to me. Like, I would be personally proud to have that, even though I wasn't reading the comic at the time, which would be a whole different level of, you know, quote unquote bragging rights. But, you know, because if you own the copy from way back when because you just happen to be reading, like, how cool is that compared to just saying, I own this copy, or I don't, you know, you don't even own the arc, you just own the issue.
Sort of like you were getting at, it's sort of about creating your own narrative in finding or discovering the book in its own right. And I think that's really what drives people consciously or subconsciously to avoid the idea that you go into a shop or you go on eBay or you pay some crazy amount at a con where they already know they've got you over the barrel real bad from the look in your eyes. And just being able to have a narrative where someone asks you, oh, well, how did you find this? And you're like, well, I was in the back room looking through the 13th long box that day, and my fingers were bleeding.
And it turns out that this book wasn't filed in alphabetical order, and I happened to come across it in the middle of, you know, Secret Origins, and
Ultimately, you know, a narrative where it's like, someone else fucked up and I took advantage, as opposed to, well, I went on eBay and someone knew that I wanted it really bad and I didn't attempt to barter with them at all and I've got it, but at a deep, deep price or something. Yeah. There's something about just some desire to not be the person who, you know, really just gives up everything for it, I guess.
Yeah, because anybody could do that. I mean, that's the thing. Anybody could just pony up enough money and find something. It's more about the effort you put in. And it has that sentimental value, you know? I think,
totally.
You know, it's kind of, it's a somewhat related story, but a couple of years ago, I found an old issue of Justice League of America for my dad for like Father's Day. And it was an issue that he had read when he was a kid. And he would always talk about there's one issue of Justice League that he read when he was a kid that stuck in his mind. It was his favorite comic book, and he read it till, you know, it fell apart. But he had bought it without a cover. It was whatever shop he was at that he bought it, had ripped the cover off and just sold the you know, the issue without the cover on it. So he didn't know what issue number it was. And then a couple years ago, I did some research. I kind of, based on what he told me of the story, I knew the characters and I knew the premise. And I figured out it was, I think, issue number 18. Which must have been, had to be like, I think, 1963 when it came out.
Oh, man.
And I was at a Comic Con around Father's Day, and I'm like, I'm just going to see if they have it. And I found it, and it was like, I think, $20. Not in great condition, obviously.
Right. You know,
the cover's falling off. I'm like, well, this is the issue. So I bought it and gave it to him for Father's Day, and he's like, he read it. He's like, yep, this is the issue. So he finally got to see the cover. It was like this weird, super sentimental, like, that he didn't even
Paul
know
has
he
to
wanted,
like not so. Show his hand while he's at like this con or whatever. They're like, oh, what is this for? And he's like, yeah. Oh, it's for my dad. It has deep sentimental value. They're like $80.
Exactly. Yeah. $100.
Well, it means a lot to him. $120.
But it's so interesting that these physical items that in most sense are kind of worthless. They're just paper and ink and staples. But, you know, they have value based on not what they're worth, not a dollar value, but the sentimental value or connection you have to it that makes it worth that much, you know? So like an issue of OMAC I find in the dollar bin on my own is more valuable than an issue I might have ordered online for $5 or $6.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, and there's like there's a weird balance that we play here. I think that the three of us are pretty much at a point where, you know, comic books aren't about the bragging rights. Comic books aren't about the, you know, despite what I said, you know, before about the bragging rights to say, you know, I own the first appearance of Gambit. It's not necessarily about that. It's like, what do these characters mean to us? Why are they so important that we would go above and beyond what is, you know, regularly asked for as a comic book reader, where you just go pick up your books every week to hunt down these issues? Because it's not like we want to necessarily read them. We just we want to be able to say, like, we have the original format of this thing. We have an actual physical representation of what this thing means to us. And just for our own personal sake, we're not trying to necessarily whip these out and go, look at this, look what I've got. Like, we're not going to be that guy who walks you into an air-conditioned room with a bunch of pristine plastic long boxes.
Put on these gloves.
I mean, we're going to pull all of these comics out of this Mylar bag, and it's, you know, it's very well put together, and say, look, I've got this thing and I've got that thing, which it's like a lot of like showboatsmanship, which you see, I think you see more often at comic conventions than not, where you've got these tons of shops that are just, look at all these back issues of these comics from like the 30s and 40s of, you know, Doctor Strange fighting Batman somehow because Marvel decided to do this thing in the 70s. And it's like, unless someone, like, I mean, and if someone has the connection to that issue, that's awesome. But I think a lot of these guys are like, well, we've got this and we've got that. And I've never felt like a care about it. Like, they're just like, look at all these things, we're going to charge you a bunch of money for it because we got it CGC graded. Because that's where we get back to that topic that we've talked about a long time ago, about if you're getting into comics for money, you picked the wrong industry.
Absolutely.
Like these, and there's nothing wrong with what these guys are doing. I think obviously it's their day job. It's what they do for their job. But I don't know. I'm not saying they should charge any less, but you don't need to be a dick about it, I guess, is what I'm saying.
It's true about most things, Mike. You don't need to be a dick about it.
Oh, yeah. I guess that's true. Yeah. But what do these books mean to you guys? Like, what, I mean, to kind of go back to it, I mean, like, what kind of, like, Why these books? Why not anything else? Like, what's so important about these specific books to you? I know we kind of talked about it, but like, why doesn't the trade satisfy you, Paul, of the, like, or finding a trade of that 2001 book? Why would that be not as good as the single issues?
I mean, part of it is the scarcity, like I mentioned. If they were to finally say, like, look, we got the rights back for the movie, Marvel, and we can now reprint Jack Kirby's 2001.
Mm-hmm.
It would still be missing something because, like I said, I'll buy Jack Kirby comics I already own in trade or digitally if I find them physically in the right circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to shell a ton of money because I don't have a lot of money, but if I can find the issues cheaply, there is something about the physicality of it, having the original and seeing the cover. And I kind of like reading old comics like that because you see the ads. It's like, this is the
comic book reading it's experience. Coming into contact with history, really.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, this medium is designed to make money. You know, it's a commercial object, but there's something kind of like satisfying about that because it's back then it was like no one thought they'd be making money on this stuff. I mean, only Jack Kirby thought that there'd be stores dedicated to selling only comics.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
He's the only person that ever thought that before they existed. So, I mean, there's something about the history of it. It's like, this was something that a kid bought with his, you know, allowance or his, you know,
poorly allocated lunch money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He didn't buy milk for a couple days a week and then saved it up to buy this issue. And like, now it's in my hands. There's something you can't quite put your finger on with that. I had the same experience when I collected Doom Patrol, the Grant Morrison Doom Patrol,
mm-hmm.
which I'm on record on this podcast saying is my favorite comic book of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
I tracked it down on eBay. I just found somebody that was selling like a bunch of issues for like a quarter a piece. Like, hey, I found these in my dad's attic. I don't know what they're worth. I'm just going to sell them on eBay. I'm like, I'll take them.
Paul writes back, nothing.
Send them to me.
You fool.
I got them all. And there were some big gaps. I had to go to other dollar bins and stuff and like track down the issues I was missing. But there was something about sitting down and reading them issue by issue as opposed to just buying like the five or six trades that they published of it. Right. And oddly enough, there was one issue I could never find, and it was the Grant Morrison Doom Patrol Doom Force one shot, where it's just Grant Morrison making fun of Rob Liefeld for like 30 pages.
Listeners, and if you know where to find that book,
pages,
let us
know.
Well,
the thing is, I found it. It was on Comixology a couple months ago, and it was like 99 cents as part of one of their sales. They were selling all the Doom Patrol stuff for real cheap. So like, I'll at least read it. And I read it. I'm like, boy, I'm glad I didn't try to track this one down because it's completely inconsequential. It's not very good or very funny. But I eventually read it, I guess. But you know, it's something like I said, that physicality of I like reading single issues as opposed to trades anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the backup material. I like reading letters pages and ads and all that. So
letters pages back in the day, though, like 70s, 80s, and even 90s, the letters pages were wild back then.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like there was less of a corporate. Yeah, less of a corporate influence. And yeah, pre-internet. That was like your only way to contact these people.
They're just like speculating and they're like, please don't kill so-and-so. And, yeah. You know, I really wonder if these two characters are going to get together. And then Stanley is always like, well, I'm not going to tell you shit, kid. So
Excelsior.
Just keep buying them. Yep.
Yeah. Tell your parents you gotta have it. No.
that guy no, was like the biggest propaganda seller I've ever heard. Like his just the way that he presented like his approach to comics was great, but he was also like half brainwashing people into like trying to convince them that comics were like the end all be all to culture in
Don't
in
tell things. Me True Believers is not a cult.
Oh yeah.
True Believers. It's a cult. Are you a true believer or a foul deviant?
Okay. Oh God, Stan Lee, wow. Evil Dictator. That's
Stan Lee.
I'd read that comic.
Absolutely.
He's just wearing the Emperor's cloak from Star Wars, and he's just like, excellent. Your training is complete.
Excelsior, your training is complete.
And he just force lightnings you. Stan Lee, if you're one of our listeners, first off, wow. Second off, sorry.
We love you.
We lost you.
We love you. You're so important to culture that we can make fun of you. Because that's what that is at the end of the day, right? If you're making fun of something, that means it's important in culture.
Right.
Exactly. Right. But Paul's completely right. Like, single issues, there's something, there's like a window to history there. And it's like, if you just get the comic on Comixology, it's sort of, you're just getting the window into the comic and you're like, okay, that's what I missed. I guess that happened. Whatever, but when you have the full comic there, it's just so, like Paul said, the ads are great, and sometimes the irrational fusions of ads and comic where all of a sudden you're just going panel to panel, and it's like, wait, are they trying to sell me something here? Hold on.
They still do
that.
Oh,
they are.
They still do that a little bit. They are.
All of the ads trying to, like, get you to learn karate via a correspondence course. And you know what? If they made a fucking coffee table book of 80s and 90s Nintendo ads,
oh,
yeah.
I would buy the ever-loving shit out of that.
There is an Instagram account that I follow. It's called Comic Book Ads. And all they do is just post pictures or scans of ads from the all the way from the 50s up until the late 90s of just random things. Usually they're like relevant to something that may have happened in comics, and it's kind of like, haha, look at what we did 20, 30 years ago. But a lot of the times it's just like random like bodybuilder things. It's like, get strong in 6 weeks. And, you know, there's a big, huge, you know, strong man on the
We'll send you these hypno glasses in the mail so you can see through people's clothes.
Exactly. And it, so it's a whole account that's dedicated to that. And again, but I think that having a coffee book table of that would be really cool, too.
Have you guys seen, minor tangent, have you guys seen the Legend of Zelda commercial with Paul Rudd in it, a very young Paul Rudd?
No.
Yes.
You'll have to look that up.
Is this that thing with the wheelchair and the little alien E.T. knockoff shit movie that he always shows on Conan? No, that's
You're talking about Mac and Me.
I think it is anything like that. Now I really need to know what the fuck you're talking about.
You're talking about Mac and Me.
Yeah,
the movie Mac and Me.
Yeah. Oh no!
Yeah,
Mac and Me.
So every time Paul Rudd is on Conan,
I never dreamt that movie would come up on this podcast.
I have got my copy right here, Nick. I could.
You have a copy of that movie?
Of course, I love Mac and Me. It's my favorite movies.
Oh, good gracious.
There's a white whale no one needs to pursue.
That was a beached whale that Paul decided to take.
It's a beached whale that does not deserve to have Greenpeace pushing it back out into the waters. Just let it die.
Oh, God.
I had to rescue Mac and Me, guys. I had to rescue
Is that the one where he always shows that clip of, like, what is it? The thing falling into
the kid in the wheelchair falling into the water, and then the little alien pops up and goes, like, woo-wee, or some fucking weird sound. Oh, comic
so,
books.
You know, some white whales are worth pursuing, and some aren't, and there's Mac and Me for you, but... Yeah. I think if anything else, to maybe try to bring this back around, there's something about those white whales so frequently, especially with them being so old and dated, that it's just a nostalgia, whether it's tapping into an era that you're not familiar with, or one that you were raised on yourself, or one that, you know, has great importance to a relative or a family member or something like that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean... If we're going to, I mean, the one thing I don't think we necessarily we touched on too much was, you know, like those hard to find variant covers. I mean, mine was a hard to find variant cover, but like in the last 10 or 15 years, I don't think that like your quote unquote white whale search is as great anymore. I think that there's a lot of like prevalence for any kind of book. And if you want a variant bad enough, you can probably find it in a way or get your shop to get it to you if you're lucky.
With like DC and Marvel, they've sort of shied away from the whole thing by, you know, variant months now, where it's either a 1-to-1 or a 1-to-2. And so some months it just becomes a mini white whale search where they put the variant cover in my pull box, and then I have to go on a mini white whale search to get the original.
It's just called a search. Case at that in point, it's just a search.
I'm not mad or itching, you know, chomping at the bit here to share a fun story from yesterday, but, I got I got the Harley's Little Black Book polybagged Batman variant of 47.
Me too.
Because the normal Batman 47s were damaged, and I like my Greg Capullo covers, so I'm gonna have to find one of those. So I've got a new white whale on my horizon, and it's a very rare book called Batman 47, normal cover. That being said, though, maybe we'll do an on-air reveal. Apparently, these polybagged variant covers are all Harley Quinn-based, but some are just... And this is kind of interesting. Some are just inked. Some are just penciled. Well, some are inked and penciled. Some are just penciled, and some are the full actual drawing. But I guess some of them are actually sketches by the artists themselves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
Yeah. So who knows? Maybe I've got the 1 in 80 billion, which is the Alex Ross cover. So I will let you know
next week on I Read Comic Books.
Next week on I Read Comic Books. But I mean, that is sort of my mini white whale that happens every week or two, is when I suddenly realize that
everything's a white whale.
And maybe
whale
I need
now.
To actually, yeah. you know,
I said everything's a white whale hunt now.
Yeah, well,
I'm on a white whale hunt for my car keys. I can't find them.
I'm always looking for them. One day I'll find those.
What is it with dryers always causing me to go on a white whale hunt for that extra sock, you know? Extra sock, like, if I use the word Jesus.
We've now thankfully abused the term white whale to a point that it now means nothing, so that's good.
Yes.
But
Moby Dick means nothing. Don't go see that movie, even if Chris Hemsworth's in it.
What movie?
I don't even know. Man in...
It's like in the heart of the wild. Heart of the sea or heart of something. The darkness. Okay. There's darkness and wilds and hearts involved.
Yeah, we've... Yeah.
In some way, shape, or form. Yeah, I guess he like lost a lot of weight for it. I don't know if you've seen the pictures.
Yeah, he looks... Where he's like... He doesn't look like Thor anymore. I was really confused.
He looks terrible. Like, it's one of those things where if that's supposed to, like, make people dedicated to go see the movie, like, they lost the teen girl demographic when they're like, look at Thor. He looks like he needs a sandwich and a bath.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but then that might attract a different crowd of people who are just like want to nurse Hemsworth back to life. You're just like, come here, my baby. I need to feed you.
The survivalist audience is all about this. Yeah. Yeah, who knows?
Different demographics, man.
Yeah, I'm really glad this eventually got to literal white whales. Yeah.
I figured we had to talk about Moby Dick at some point, right?
Yeah.
Despite how ridiculous
Ron Howard
that
doesn't bat a thousand either, what can I say?
Yeah. Next time on Arrested Development, right? I love Ron Howard simply because he did the Arrested Development like voiceover for everything, and then I look at like his movies and I go like, this guy's got range in terms of like what he's willing to do to make a dollar on TV, from right. Happy Days all the way to like this movie.
Don't forget, what was that?
Andy Griffith.
One
show.
With Andy Griffith.
Oh, Andy Griffith.
He was
right.
The kid.
Yeah. Yeah. For some reason,
he actually wasn't supposed to be the announcer on Arrested. He was actually just a placeholder.
Oh, really? And then he just became part of the show.
Found someone, and they just
Well. The more you know.
Just stuck with it. Huh. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. This episode was produced by Mike Rappin and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Deluxe, Young Bay, Ancient Astronauts, and Infinity Shred. If you're listening to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, we'd love it if you would take a quick moment to rate us. Comments and ratings help others find the show and let us know how we're doing. Otherwise, if you just want to say hi, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. Each email means a lot to us and lets us interact with you on a personal level. Maybe you started reading a book we suggested. Maybe you have a book to suggest to us. If email's not your game, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter @destroythecyb. Follow us on Tumblr @DestroyTheCyborg, or check out our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. Seriously, check out the subreddit. Mike is lonely there. And as always, thank you for listening.
Paul, I wish you would have told me you were looking for that Archie variant. I seriously could probably still get it for like regular price.
If you can still find it for regular price, maybe $10 max.
I will look for it next time I'm at Midtown, because they still have a ton of Archie variants. Like, when Archie number one came out, they filled an entire like third of a shelf with just Archie number one variants. I'd have known, man, I could have got it.
Oh, well, Mike, by the way, I was looking in the previews catalog, and I think we were talking about like how long is Annie Wu going to be on this anyway?
Yeah,
and I think she is slotted for. I think only 4 through 6.
Okay.
Because they've got somebody new on board for 7.
Okay. Well, like, number 4 was kind of a one-shot, so I wouldn't be surprised if they rotated artists for the next 2 issues.
Oh. No, it's an interesting book. What can I say? Oh, I was going to mention, how could I forget this? I read Archie versus Predator.
Oh.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
And... the back matter in that book is fantastic. It's like 30 pages of variant covers. There's a huge letter from the editor about like how the whole project.
You read the trade, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There's a letter from the editor about how the whole project, came about between Fox/Dark Horse/Archie, and Like, they got permission to do whatever they wanted, like, no holds barred.
No way.
And I don't know if I want to give anything away, but they make the most of that. They completely make the most of that. I mean, do you guys care? Because no, I'll just
ahead.
Throw this in here.
Go ahead.
They, yeah. It kills everybody. It kills Archie.
Does it really?
It kills everyone. Yes. Oh, save Betty and Veronica, who then use this weird machine of, which one's the wealthy one? Veronica?
Yeah. Veronica, yeah.
She's got this weird future, like, medical machine because her dad's wealthy or whatever, and they use it to turn the Predator, which they capture at the end, they use it to turn him into, like, a Predator-Archie hybrid.
What?
Whoa. And they're like, this is close enough, tee-hee! And that's the end. And I'm like, what the fuck?
That's fantastic.
But it kills Archie, and it's not, it's gross. Like, it's like, it, like, he explodes into, like, brain matter and eyeballs and ocular stems or whatever those are called. Ooh.
Okay.
Yeah. Read it.
Maybe
read
if
it,
I can get that on it. Sale on Comixology, I might grab it.
When did I pick that? That was a Dark Horse Black Friday sale. I got it for $3, so I don't know if you're going to be able to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, eventually they
see that again. But
Comixology's been doing so many Dark Horse sales lately.
Yeah.
That like I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. No, really.
Hmm.
I was gonna say, Paul. I don't know if you've been paying attention. I told Mike already, but they've got Rebels 1-5. For $1 a piece
still
on
sale
right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that series is great. Like, if you, I mean, I always feel like Revolutionary War narratives aren't, like, they aren't out there. It's still sort of semi-untapped in a weird way, so.
But it's Brian Wood, and we're all supposed to not like him. So.
Right.
It's weird how he is one of those people that's, like, sometimes, like, he's super on point and then completely off.
Right.
Like,
that's because he does CrossFit. That's what I've been told.
I'm just gonna say this. Just I don't care. The Massive started to really bore me,
Nick,
at a certain point.
You're fucking wrong about that.
Okay.
I
was
don't
like
know.
Brian Wood. I got it. You did your research. You did a lot of research.
That first arc is very research.
Maybe too much. No, arc 2. I got to 2. I read book 1. I got to book 2, and at that point, I was like, oh my god, facts.
Yeah, I can
so,
see it.
Sorry.
Did you read that at all, Paul?
No.
Okay.
No.
I don't know. What are your thoughts on that man, on Brian Wood?
I'm trying to remember.
Or at
what
least,
exactly
what are your thoughts
I
on
read.
Brian Wood's work?
He did
separate from his.
He's done a little bit of X-Men. He did
DMZ.
Yeah, and he did
Northlanders,
Massive, Northlanders, Demo.
Okay, Northlanders. I really really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And he did. Did he do New York 5?
Yes, he did. And New York 4.
I read New York 4. I haven't read New York 5 yet, but New York 4 I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
So
New York 5 is pretty good. It's not as well thought out, I think, as New York 4 was. Like, it's so funny. I love the whole premise of New York 4 is like all about cell phones and like.
Yeah.
Because when that book came out, like it was totally right. I mean, that was a pretty early book for him. And so like cell phones were still newish. And so like the premise about it, of it like being all around her having a BlackBerry and being weird and talking to people on her BlackBerry was so funny to me because I'm like everybody does that, you know, nowadays, like when I read the book, which is like 2 years
strange.
ago, and so it's such a good like slice of culture at the time.
Definitely.
And I still really liked it, though, like putting myself in that mindset of remember when not everyone had cell phones and remember when people talked to each other, you know, on the phone rather than just texting. Things like
I
that.
Remember. Yeah. I remember.
Yeah, yeah. I was 14. It was a crazy time.
We were all on AIM.
Yeah.
No. And we were. Yep. And
speaking of that, have you guys heard of this game called Emily is Away?
Yeah, it's sort of making its rounds on a whole bunch of pop culture websites right now and a whole bunch of YouTube Let's Plays and whatnot.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. If you grew up in the AOL Instant Messenger days, oh man, it's really good.
Oh, I was going to mention, just because you guys were talking about like technology and history within books and whatnot. Like, obviously, I think I said I've been reading The Losers, which came out in like 2003,
Yeah.
/2004.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy the sort of things that book is saying about, like the Iraq War and, like, Middle Eastern conflict and whatnot, like, so close to the invasion. Like Diggle was writing about all of this stuff as it was happening.
And, yeah.
Like, he was, like, on top of it. Like, it's crazy. Like,
I think he is a brilliant writer. When he's in the correct story. I don't think all of his work is like the best. I did like his Daredevil, but I know that there's like been, you know, back and forth opinions about it. But like The Losers, for instance, like that's a really, really smart book.
Like geopolitical espionage and everything. Holy cow. He is like on top of like all of this stuff. It's crazy. And to have a book that's like such a crazy combination of like this knowledge of like military intelligence and secret ops and how like geopolitical, like, you know, world assets work and all that stuff. And then it's also this kick-ass crazy balls to the wall adventure book. And it's the same damn book. And it's like, how is this even a thing? So thank you, Andy Diggle. It's a good read. Sometimes it's a little too smart for me, I'm afraid, because I guess I don't understand all of it. But then it's like, boom, headshot. And I'm like, I get that part. That part was cool. That thing exploded. Don't worry, I'm with you. I'm with you so far. I gotcha. But I'm at that point in volume two where they start rotating artists, because I guess maybe Jock had other stuff to do to... Mixed reception, although Nick Dragotta does the first arc of Volume 2. I thought that was really interesting. Or Dragotta.
Nick Dragotta,
Manhattan
yeah.
Projects guy. Yeah.
Yeah, so I saw his weird. Work. What was I reading the other day? And Nick Dragotta, it was like an older book, and I was like, holy shit, this is Nick Dragotta doing something that isn't East of West. Like, it blew my mind, because I didn't know what he did before that book.
Other than Manhattan
Well, Projects. Yeah, he did Manhattan Projects. Did he do Manhattan Projects?
Oh man, am I wrong? That's him, right?
No, that's Nick Patara.
Oh fuck.
And Ryan Brown, who did his God Hates Astronauts. Ryan Brown did like one-off issues in Manhattan Projects.
Now that makes me wonder who the heck was doing that run in Losers. It was probably Dragotta. Okay. Yeah. It's always weird when you, like, associate some artist or, you know, someone with something so permanently that when you see them doing something else, it's like,
yeah,
what's going on?
Yeah. Now I'm trying to find, I can't remember what it was I was reading.
Where you saw who?
Which Nick Dragotta's art. I gotta Google his name.
Didn't he do some Marvel work?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the only thing I can tell you.
And that's what I think it was.
Comic Book DB, sort by chronological order, and you're set. That site is so good, honestly. I can't plug that one enough. That one is just perfect.
Oh, yeah, he did work on FF. Shit.
That's right.
Was that back when that was two books, or was it a book that was published twice?
This is no John Hickman's FF.
Wasn't that when Allred was doing the art?
No, that was Matt Fraction.
Oh my, which one was first?
John Hickman.
Okay.
He did do issues on The Losers.
Which one now, Dragotta?
Dragotta.
Dragotta did. Okay.
Man, what was I reading? Now I'm like.
That makes more sense, because I was thinking in the back of my head, it was like Patera, but Patera's style is like, you know it when you see it.
It's scraggly. It kind of reminds me of the same art that's on They're Not Like Us a little bit.
Oh, Simon Gain?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, a little bit. Gain seems a little bit more refined.
Yeah, definitely more refined.
I keep trying to pitch that book to people, and no one wants to read that book.
Because it's a really...
It just must be me. I don't know.
It's a weird book to try to explain to anybody.
I just say it's X-Men, but they're dicks. They're self-obsessed dicks. You know, they understand that with these abilities don't come responsibility, but money, and nice vinyl libraries, and a willingness to get away with anything.
Yeah.
Why is that not appealing?